Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Newt Gingrich, The Rise and Fall of a Party Entrepreneur by Matthew N. Green and Jeffrey Crouch. Narrated by Mike Lenz. Publisher's note. In this audio edition, you will hear references to figures and tables present in the print and ebook formats of the book. Preface. My enemies will write histories that dismiss me and prove I was unimportant. My friends will write histories that glorify me and prove I was more important than I was. And two generations or three from now, some serious, sober historian will write a history that sort of implies I was whoever I was. Newt Gingrich, January 1985. When Newt Leroy Gingrich made these remarks to a Washington Post reporter, he was a minority party backbencher in the U.S. House of Representatives, effective at grabbing attention but excluded from the political power structure of Congress and unpopular with Democratic and Republican legislators alike. Few could have imagined that a decade later, he would be sworn in as the first Republican Speaker of the House since the mid-1950s. Nor did anyone, except perhaps Gingrich himself, believe that the Georgia congressman would go down in history as one of the most consequential and controversial figures in American politics. Whether the result of impressive foresight or an outsized ego, Gingrich's prediction about how his time in Congress would be evaluated has so far been accurate. Most biographies of Gingrich are as polarizing as the man himself, either sharply critical of his congressional career or adamant that he dramatically changed the nation for the better. In this book, we take a different approach. Though we are political scientists, not historians, and we write less than two generations after Gingrich spoke the aforementioned words, our goal is to provide a serious, sober review and analysis of his time in Congress and his contributions to U.S. politics. By cutting through the partisan rhetoric that surrounds his time in the House, and by drawing upon both older journalistic accounts and new archival and interview data, we endeavor to shed fresh light onto what Gingrich did, why he did it, and how he may have changed Congress, if not the country, in the process. The story of Gingrich's 20 years as a U.S. representative can be told in a variety of ways, from the perspective of bold institutional change in the House, which he helped bring about, as a cautionary tale on how to amass but then lose power in a legislature, or as an example of how individual lawmakers may shape and be shaped by political polarization. We examine Gingrich from a fresh perspective. Gingrich, we argue, was a case study of party entrepreneurship in Congress, exemplifying how certain lawmakers devote scarce time and resources toward a particular political or policy outcome that benefits their congressional party. Viewing Gingrich as a party entrepreneur underscores his unremitting drive to bring the House Republican Party to power and revolutionize American society, a level of devotion that differentiated him from most of his colleagues. Our approach also allows us to draw parallels between Gingrich and other congressional entrepreneurs in history. In the end, this perspective helps us to better understand the reasons for Gingrich's successes and failures in Congress, both as a minority party rabble-rouser and as Speaker of the House, and reveals the ways that party entrepreneurs like Gingrich have profoundly influenced legislative politics. Chapter 1. Newt Gingrich, Party Entrepreneur. Tip O'Neill, the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, was livid. 1 week earlier, a junior legislator from Georgia named Newt Gingrich had risen on the floor of the House and accused numerous Democrats of being communist sympathizers. The chamber was virtually empty at the time, but Gingrich implied that the pro-communism Democrats were sitting quietly in the audience, unwilling to rebut his charges. O'Neill called it unfair and deceptive. Gingrich demanded an opportunity to respond. Now, back on the House floor, O'Neill, Gingrich, and other Democrats were exchanging more heated words. Finally, the Speaker had heard enough. His voice rising in anger, he pointed a finger at Gingrich. "My personal opinion," he said, "is this. You deliberately stood in that well before an empty house and challenged these people, and you challenged their Americanism. And it is the lowest thing that I have ever seen in my 32 years in Congress. O'Neill's words, delivered in fury on that May 1984 day, captured how most Democrats felt about Gingrich. But his remarks also violated the rules of the chamber, which prohibit any lawmaker, including the Speaker, from impugning the character or behavior of another representative. As a result, O'Neill was reprimanded by the presiding officer, and his words were taken down, an extremely rare punishment for a Speaker of the House. Although the skirmish had been brief, it generated a slew of news stories, catapulted Gingrich into the national limelight, and epitomized what made him one of the most important political figures of the 20th century. First elected to the House in 1978, the Georgia congressman quickly stood out as a tireless critic of the chamber's governing Democratic Party, and he led a cadre of younger Republican lawmakers to employ new tactics and attention-getting feats, including partisan floor battles like the one between him and O'Neill, designed to end the GOP's long-running minority status. He is often credited with bringing his party to power in 1994, ending its 40 years in the political desert, and he would become one of the most high-profile and assertive speakers of the House in modern history. While there may be broad consensus that Gingrich was a particularly prominent politician, how to properly describe and explain his motives, behavior, and influence is another matter. Scholars and observers have varyingly depicted him as an independent-minded actor who single-handedly altered his party and the House, a leader who tried but failed to be transformative, or an agent who acted in accordance with the wishes of fellow partisans. "It's not easy to explain Newt Gingrich," wrote Frank Grigorski, one of his erstwhile aides. "He was such a complicated individual," recalled a former GOP leader in an interview with the authors, and speakership scholar Ronald Peters described him as a man of many parts. Further muddling the effort to explain Gingrich and generalize about his two decades in Congress is that he served in both the minority and the majority, moving from powerless backbencher to Speaker of the House, and that some of his most important contributions occurred when he was outside the formal leadership structure of his party. In this book, we argue that Gingrich exemplified a particular type of elected representative we call a party entrepreneur. Unlike the typical member of Congress, who fixates primarily on cultivating support within his own district or state to get reelected, party entrepreneurs dedicate their scarce resources to strategically create or exploit opportunities that will assist their political party. By introducing this new conceptual model and applying it to Gingrich, we underscore what made him unusual while also suggesting similarities between him and other legislators who prioritized the political success of their party. Thinking of Gingrich as a party entrepreneur helps explain much of his behavior and political style, including his iconoclasm, attention to strategy, and willingness to take risks and try fresh tactics, like coordinating floor appearances by his GOP allies and delivering provocative statements in the public sphere to realize his objectives. Together with insights gleaned from military strategy, the model of party entrepreneurship also helps illuminate some reasons for his successes, particularly during his time in the minority party, when he had less power but greater freedom of action. It also explains Gingrich's failures, including his forced resignation from the House after four tumultuous years as Speaker, which coincided with entrepreneurial goals that were either too ambitious for the resources he had at his disposal or crowded out by the responsibilities of governing. Besides using a novel paradigm to examine his congressional career, our study differs in several ways from past profiles of Gingrich. Most biographers have concentrated on his time as Speaker. By contrast, we survey his 16 years in Congress before he became Speaker, when he undertook some of his most noteworthy and consequential acts, as well as his speakership. We also draw upon new interviews and archival data to document Gingrich's major contributions, including those that have received little attention. In addition, we discussed that while Gingrich did less to shape the country's political landscape than some have asserted, his entrepreneurship had two profound consequences. First, it helped him realize his own ambitions for power and become a speaker with tremendous, if short-lived, political influence. Second, it pushed the House of Representatives to become what it is today, a centralized chamber in which political parties act as loyalty-based teams that devote substantial time and energy to electioneering and partisan messaging. Prior studies of Gingrich. Newt Gingrich has been the subject of more books, articles, and essays than just about any other modern speaker or member of Congress. Despite his colorful and provocative personality, most academic studies of the man minimize his individual contributions and distinctiveness, explaining his leadership as the result of broad causal variables. Political scientist Richard Fenno argued that Gingrich's speakership was molded by the GOP's 40 frustrating years in the minority, and if he had not come along, it would have been another confrontational partisan very much like him leading the Republican conference. Another political scientist, Barbara Sinclair, theorized that because leaders in Congress are focused first and foremost on meeting the expectations of fellow partisans, Gingrich was merely one of many speakers whose leadership style reflected the goals of his party. Whether that required being assertive, as in his first term as speaker, or more compromising, as in his second. Her approach reflects a widely held view among scholars that factors within Congress, most notably a party's ideological homogeneity, direct the behavior of leaders. There is a second school of thought, promoted by some social scientists, as well as most journalists and non-academics, that emphasizes Gingrich's independence and exceptionality. Political scientists Ronald Peters and Craig Williams, for instance, write that Gingrich was a transformational leader, but a unique one insofar as his efforts as Speaker to reshape the House and American politics more broadly largely failed. Analyzing his worldview, another political scientist, John Pitney, describes Gingrich as ideologically idiosyncratic and unusually intellectual for a member of Congress. Far more than most political leaders, he writes, Gingrich roots his actions in books and ideas, and he should not be pigeonholed as a conservative, at least as people ordinarily define the term. Some have highlighted how, unlike other modern speakers, Gingrich attempted to turn the federal government into a parliamentary system, centralizing power within the speakership and positioning the chamber to be the center of national policymaking. Several journalists and scholars stress his novel use of procedure and media campaigns to heighten differences between the parties, or his pleas that rank-and-file Republicans should act more aggressively against Democrats. For others, it was elements of Gingrich's personal style that set him apart, such as his endless embrace of new ideas, his energy and perseverance, his frequent use of hyperbolic and oversimplified rhetoric, or his impulsiveness, inconsistency, and lack of follow-through. Finally, there have been a few attempts to bridge the perspective of Gingrich as a typical party agent and the argument that he was independent and unique. Political scientist Randall Strahan argued that Gingrich was a transformational speaker, unusual, but not alone in that respect. Two other speakers, Henry Clay and Thomas Brackett Reed, also took bold steps to alter the House and their own political party. Dissenting from Sinclair's depiction of Gingrich as following the will of the GOP conference, Strahan asserted that he was a conditional agent who independently brought about considerable political and policy change because he possessed both strongly held objectives and followers who wanted to end the status quo, but disagreed over what change would be best. In an earlier work, one of us noted how Gingrich, like other speakers of the House, was occasionally motivated to exercise legislative leadership on behalf of issues that mattered to him personally, not necessarily to his party. There are also a handful of scholars who have acknowledged that, even if a party's homogeneity and collective preferences matter a great deal in explaining what leaders in Congress do, one should allow for leader autonomy, provided certain conditions are met and leaders are already inclined to act more independently. The danger of the first perspective is that it overgeneralizes Gingrich, reducing him to a typical congressional leader when he clearly was not. The second conceptualization avoids that trap, but at the same time fails to acknowledge that he was hardly the only lawmaker of his kind to spend ceaseless hours trying to help his party fulfill its collective goals. Instead, like Strahan, we take the middle ground, honing in on what made Gingrich out of the ordinary, but not quite one of a kind. Unlike Strahan, however, we review Gingrich's entire congressional career, not just his speakership. And we focus more broadly on his entrepreneurial politics, something he shared with other distinctive and consequential party leaders and members of Congress. Party entrepreneurship in Congress. Elected representatives can bring about change in many ways. Some do so as entrepreneurs, driven individuals who identify opportunities to provide a collective good and who expend resources to make it happen, often at some risk, stamping change with their own personal visions in the process. Two recognized types of entrepreneurs in Congress are procedural entrepreneurs, who bring about institutional reforms and rule changes, and legislative entrepreneurs, who contribute to policy output by introducing bills, building supportive coalitions around them, and guiding them to enactment. Procedural and legislative entrepreneurs appear regularly in the U.S. House and Senate and help explain much of what Congress does. But a common prerequisite for their success is the ability to transcend party lines and work in a bipartisan fashion. For example, bills are far more likely to become law when supported by cross-party coalitions. Yet, political parties have long been the principal organizing structures within Congress, and in recent decades, the House and Senate have become more politically polarized, making party organizations increasingly important. There is, thus, the potential for a third type of entrepreneur, party entrepreneurs, or members of Congress, either formal party leaders or members of the rank and file, who work to achieve their party's collective goals. Party entrepreneurs may, for example, recruit new candidates to challenge incumbents of the other party, raise sums for vulnerable same-party incumbents, or employ communication tactics to improve their party's brand and dent the image of the other party. If one assumes that some members of Congress act as party entrepreneurs, what motivates them to do so? After all, it seems unlikely that aiding one's congressional party will do much to help an individual lawmaker achieve her preeminent objective of getting reelected, except perhaps indirectly by improving the party's reputation. Indeed, one of the major risks of party entrepreneurship is that it directs time and resources away from passing bills or conducting readily observed district-centered activities that will please constituents. But more than re-election drives legislator behavior. Richard Fenno identified three goals, re-election, policy enactment, and internal influence, that motivate lawmakers. Whereas party entrepreneurship does not lend itself to the pursuit of making policy, it does correspond well with an aspiration for more internal influence, since an ambitious lawmaker ultimately needs the support of fellow partisans to be selected or reselected as leader, and a surefire way of gaining that support is to provide party-wide collective benefits. We therefore expect to see evidence of ambition for greater internal power among party entrepreneurs, though they may also value that entrepreneurship in and of itself. Party entrepreneurs, like entrepreneurs in general, are usually strategic, acting in ways that are reasonably expected to attain their objectives. What are the strategies that party entrepreneurs follow, and what makes those strategies more or less likely to succeed? While the answers to these questions will vary by entrepreneur, by objective, and by circumstances, we can glean some general insights from theories of strategic action. Strategic decision-making by legislators is often excluded from theories of Congress, with the notable exception of game-theoretic models, that offer predictions about the behavior of individuals seeking to maximize their own benefits in uncertain environments. But one field that does consider strategy in great depth and that can shed light on the nature and consequences of strategic behavior by congressional entrepreneurs is military theory. Political conflict and military combat are not the same. But as Clausewitz famously observed, they are related, and the combative nature of congressional party politics has encouraged some scholars to draw upon military analogies and theories to explain it. Party entrepreneurs, in particular, share some similarities with military leaders. They are purposive, risk-taking actors. They possess an array of broader objectives that often include helping one's own party, or army, and they engage with an opposing group in conflicts that are frequently zero-sum. One military-related paradigm that can be used to not just conceptualize the behavior of entrepreneurs in Congress, but also analyze their effectiveness, is Arthur Leik Jr.'s three-legged stool model of military strategy. Drawing from General Maxwell Taylor's description of strategy as a combination of ends, ways, and means, Leik posited that military strategy comprises three distinct elements: immediate objectives, strategic concepts, that is, the tactics used to achieve those objectives, and the resources employed to carry them out. Those objectives, concepts, and resources constitute the three legs of a proverbial stool. And just as a three-legged stool must have all three legs of equal size and strength to avoid tipping over, so too must a sound military strategy with minimal risk of failure include objectives, concepts, and resources that are viable and proportionate to one another. When applied to the congressional setting, this model suggests that, like military strategy, the political strategy of party entrepreneurs can be separated into objectives, methods, and resources, and that a party entrepreneur's likelihood of success is contingent upon all three being reasonable and evenly matched. Leik's model is not predictive. A strategist can succeed or fail for a host of reasons outside of her control. But it does suggest that when a party entrepreneur in Congress is able to increase the congruence of all three legs, such as by increasing available resources or tempering her objectives, she is more likely to advance her strategic goals. We explore this idea, along with the claim that the pursuit of power motivates party entrepreneurialism in Congress, by reviewing the congressional career of Newt Gingrich, whom we posit fits the profile of a party entrepreneur. Gingrich as a party entrepreneur. If Gingrich was an entrepreneur in Congress, he was certainly not a legislative one. Though he did have several policy interests, legislating was never his strong suit. During his first 6 years in the House, he consistently introduced fewer bills than an average Republican member. And when he served as Speaker, he generally delegated the task of legislative leadership to others. Another indication that Gingrich was not a legislative entrepreneur is his legislative effectiveness score, a metric developed by Craig Volden and Alan Wiseman that captures how effectively a lawmaker steers bills through the legislative process. Until his last 2 years in Congress, Gingrich's score was routinely one of the lowest ranked among his GOP peers. Nor was Gingrich principally a procedural entrepreneur. True, he contributed to some important institutional developments in the House, like the formation of the Conservative Opportunity Society Caucus in the mid-1980s, and the increased centralization of majority party power when he became Speaker. But most of Gingrich's procedural moves were means to greater ends, like helping his political party win and maintain control of the chamber and garnering more power for himself. When considering Gingrich's most noteworthy endeavors in Congress, it is clear that he was a quintessential party entrepreneur. These endeavors, which we outline in detail throughout the book, included such media and messaging tactics as using floor debate to coordinate verbal attacks on the majority party, operating a one-man press campaign to force the resignation of Speaker Jim Wright, Democrat from Texas, which undermined the morale of Democrats and demonstrated that aggressive partisanship could yield political victories for the GOP, and employing creative messaging tactics to improve his party's brand. Other entrepreneurial endeavors included sending inspirational audio tapes to potential congressional candidates, both to convince them to run for office and to persuade them to adopt Gingrich's beliefs of what constituted proper partisan behavior. Linking minority party obstruction with electoral success for the party, and pushing an assertive agenda as Speaker to harm the re-election chances of President Bill Clinton and weaken the Democratic Party's electoral base. Entrepreneurs are also usually risk-takers, and we discuss in subsequent chapters that Gingrich risked damaging his reputation, his standing among other Republicans and GOP leaders, and even his own re-election in the name of achieving his entrepreneurial goals. Applying Like's military model to what party entrepreneurs do makes particular sense in Gingrich's case, because he was deeply influenced by military history, theory, and strategy. He often drew inspiration and ideas from military theorists like Clausewitz and Sun Tzu. Paraphrasing Mao Zedong, Gingrich told an audience at the Library of Congress that politics is war without blood. War is a recurrent theme for this guerrilla captain of the political right, observed one reporter in 1984, and his one-time confidant, Representative Vin Weber, Republican from Minnesota, said, "I think that the military analogies are pretty helpful in understanding Newt Gingrich." More generally, he extolled an approach to politics that mirrored strategic thinking. His greatest asset, a former GOP lawmaker told us, was his ability to look ahead and then piece together the things needed to move forward. His thought process is a strategic thought process, noted a Hill staffer who was in Congress with Gingrich, and who explained to us that Gingrich had been influential because he was very good at taking ideas, tactics, and strategy and winding them into something that made sense. Gingrich often touted vision, strategy, projects, and tactics, a hierarchical model for achieving one's aims. And he once compared congressional Republicans to short-order cooks hired to run a gourmet French restaurant, ill-equipped with the skills and long-range thinking required to attain the bigger goal of a GOP-led Congress. Gingrich's emphasis on strategy and willingness to innovate would be critical to his success as a party entrepreneur, especially while serving in the House minority party. As the military scholar Lawrence Friedman wrote, "Underdog strategies provide the real tests of creativity." This is not to say that Gingrich's strategic skills were flawless. In a private memo written in the early 1980s, his aide, Frank Gergorski, discussed Gingrich's lack of focus, an overly ambitious agenda, and he warned that the objectives to achieve his grander goals change so fast that they amount to sprays of buckshot aimed at the side of a hill. He was prone to writing lengthy treatises for his colleagues, calling for revolutionary societal change, particularly during his early years as a congressman. And they were sometimes illustrated with complex geometric diagrams that could be difficult to decipher. One former GOP aide explained that Newt has 100 ideas a day, maybe 100 ideas an hour, and most of them went nowhere. Dennis Hastert, Republican from Illinois, recalled that Gingrich was a great political strategist, but was hard to follow because he had a good idea every 5 or 6 minutes. While a staffer for Minority Leader Robert Michael, Republican from Illinois, recalled that in a typical leadership meeting, Gingrich would pop off with just one idea after another. "We ought to do this. We ought to do that." And he'd be back a week later and have 5 more ideas. So you kind of had to guesstimate how important they were. A common joke was that Newt's ideas filled multiple file cabinets, yet just one drawer was enough to hold Newt's good ideas. His incessant brainstorming, coupled with questionable managerial skills, and, after 1994, the challenge of leading a governing party, would eventually create serious problems for him. Nonetheless, he did have goals, albeit grand ones. Gregorski noted in the same memo describing Gingrich's imperfections that puny goals are unattractive to Newt, and he could be aggressive.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?